Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. First of all, today, we're going to the world of technology. An article in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly of August the 12th has a very provocative article about 5G. It's entitled, What is 5G? And How Will It Affect Me? If the Internet was the information superhighway, as Al Gore and others famously put it, 5G is a future where every street is an autobahn with no speed limits, no data bottlenecks. It's a future perhaps as game-changing as the Internet itself. It's the fifth generation of cell phone service, using three different portions of the spectrum to create a super-fast and much more reliable service, even if you're sitting in a basement or stuck in an underground tunnel during rush hour. It's this reliability of communications, wherever you are, that could lead to innovative products and services. At first, faster phones and new cable companies. Downloads will be more than 10 times as fast as a good 4G connection, and that means you could download a full movie to your phone in seconds rather than minutes. Also, wireless companies could begin competing with cable firms to offer home internet and TV service. Eventually, your city's traffic grid would communicate with cars and vice versa to reduce bottlenecks and improve safety. Smart homes would become smarter and easier to set up. Since 5G would virtually eliminate any delays in streaming video, workers could operate bulldozers remotely and shoppers at home could try on clothes by watching a holographic 3D image of themselves dressed in the duds. Futurists call this the Internet of Things, where everything can communicate with everything else. Just when will 5G be available? Well, South Korea, China, Britain, Kuwait, and others have set up limited 5G systems. In April, Qatar hosted the world's first 5G phone call. In the United States, several cities are trying out their systems. Some early testers in Chicago reported speeds up to 1,400 megabits per second, roughly 14 times the limit of what today's 4G systems can usually deliver. And that's just the beginning. Most observers peg 2020 as the year when 5G really begins to roll out around the world. Back to 5G. When will it be mainstream? By 2025, just under half of Americans will have 5G connections. This according to Deloitte. but only a third of Europeans and a quarter of Chinese will be hooked up to the new service. Estimates suggest carriers in the U.S. will offer 5G as a premium service at first. Verizon, for example, plans to charge a $10 a month extra for the service. Its 5G phones range from $1,000 to $1,300. The rewards to companies could be amazing, with one forecast predicting a $277 billion global market by the year 2025. But are there any drawbacks? To achieve higher speeds, 5G uses radio waves in a new area of the spectrum. These radio waves don't do a good job penetrating walls and buildings. So 5G carriers will have to build a much denser network of small transmitters to complement today's cell tower technology. Some critics have raised concern that exposure to so many radio waves could have health effects. The industry, though, says no studies have uncovered any such problems. The other big concern is privacy. The more densely packed transmitters are, the more precisely users can be tracked. Other experts raise concerns that China-based Huawei, one of the most advanced and cheapest manufacturers of many 5G network components, will use its equipment to give the Chinese government a secret backdoor to the data. The Trump administration banned U.S. companies from selling equipment to Huawei, but is now considering exempting some companies from that ban. Britain shows little concern, since its carriers building 5G networks are reportedly using Huawei parts. India, by contrast, has shied away from using Huawei components, even after the company offered assurances that there would be no back door. For our next segment, we travel to Asia. There's an article in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, September the 2nd, about the following. The title, Hong Kong's Rebuke of Ethnic Patriotism. For 3 months, at least a third of Hong Kong's population of 7 million has been protesting for democratic rights in the streets of the semi-autonomous territory. Yet Beijing's leader, Xi Jinping, has not crushed the demonstrations. Why? Does he worry about economic fallout or the loss of China's hopes to be seen as a benign global leader? One possibility is that Mr. Xi would be crushing one of his claims to power. The promise of a China dream. This idea, repeated again and again, rests in part on a racial stereotype. It is the myth that all people of Chinese descent share a cultural unity and that their political identity must be defined and enforced by the Communist Party. It is this notion of ethnic patriotism or bloodlines as destiny that has been so ably challenged by the protesters. Their embrace of civil values as collective identity is not based on dimensions of Chinese-ness. They have forged a cultural unity around the daily practice of freedom of speech and assembly, equality under a system of law left by the British rule, and political transparency and accountability. Hong Kongers, which most prefer to be called instead of Chinese, have coalesced around a shared self-governance, mutual respect, and open-mindedness. China's crushing of the protests would not crush this internalized identity. A violent display of authority would expose the myth of a homogeneous ethnicity. The emperor would be seen as having no clothes. Let us continue this presentation of ethnic patriotism and its rebuke by people in Hong Kong. Since his rise to power in 2012, Mr. Xi has tried to extend the China dream to both Hong Kong and the island nation of Taiwan. In a 2015 meeting with Taiwan's then leader Ma Ying-jeou, he stated, quote, "China and Taiwan are brothers, connected by flesh, even if our bones are broken. We are a family whose blood is thicker than water," unquote. The Taiwanese, who have enjoyed democracy for 3 decades, don't buy into this claim, especially as it is made under the threat of military coercion. Nearly two-thirds of the country's 23 million citizens see themselves as Taiwanese and not Chinese. Their view is reinforced by Beijing's rising threats against the Hong Kong protesters. The China dream is based on the work of Mr. Xi's ideology mastermind, Wang Huning. The former scholar sits on the country's powerful Politburo, and his writings argue that Chinese people are prone to accept authoritarian rule out of their reverence for Confucian style. They are descendants of the dragon and not yet advanced in their thinking to reality, known to their interests. They need paternalistic rule of an unchallenged Communist Party, not a system based on the choice of individuals. Mr. Wang says democratic freedoms and basic rights are self-defeating, unquote. In their thinking and actions, Hong Kong's protesters have already overthrown Mr. Xi's ethnic branding. Their conscience is already free. Their identity is chosen, not given, and rooted in universal values, not an imposed dream of ancestral traits. Whatever crackdown may still be imposed, this self-determined identity cannot be crushed. This may be giving Mr. Xi pause. And now, for this segment, we're going underwater. An article in the August 19th and 26th issue of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly has this very informative and provocative article entitled, "An Age of Discovery Unfolds Beneath the Waves." Some 20 miles off the Monterey Bay coast, Kelly Benoit Bird lights up as a delicate pink creature drifts onto the screen in front of her, and she calls out, "A cockeyed squid! I've never seen one before." Well, Dr. Benoit Bird is on board the Rachel Carson, watching intently as live video streams from the Ventana, a remotely operated vehicle, ROV, descending through the ocean's twilight zone deep below the ship. The robotic envoy's mission, to glean insights into the twice-daily swell of tiny critters traveling up and down the water column, likely the largest migration on Earth. The excursion is part of a long-running experiment to monitor these waters and to better understand the mysteries that lie beneath the surface of the sea. The ocean covers more than 70% of the planet's surface and constitutes 95% of its living space. It contains 97% of its water and is critical to life on Earth as a source of food and oxygen and as a driver of our climate. Every other breath you take comes from ocean organisms like phytoplankton and seaweed. The ocean stabilizes our climate and is the largest carbon sink in the world, absorbing 30% of human carbon dioxide emissions. But for most people, the ocean is a world almost as alien as the moon, a smooth surface that makes a pleasing backdrop to a sunset or a fun playground for kids on the beach. But for scientists, an understanding of this world as it evolves, so too do people and their perceptions of this unfamiliar world. The ocean is the most important thing you rarely think about. You need a healthy ocean to have a habitable planet. I'm going to let you read the rest of this article on September 19th and 26th in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. But I wanted to end with the question, did you know? Did you know that coral reefs can thrive at depths where light barely reaches and waters are cold, acidic, and almost devoid of oxygen? Did you know scientists can identify which types of fish have been swimming around an area using just a bottle of seawater and the DNA in it? Did you know in the deepest and darkest, most inhospitable parts of the ocean, life does find a way and reveals clues in the search for extraterrestrial life? And finally, did you know the sea is not such a silent world? Some fish grunt aggressively or call for a mate. Haddock, for example, make a rhythmic knocking sound. And so, the more scientists learn, the clearer it becomes that the ocean, while incredibly resilient, is facing massive threats, from climate change and plastic pollution to overfishing and drilling for oil and gas. Sometimes we are destroying things before we even begin to discover them. And each new discovery reveals just how much we still have to learn. Now, a few items that you might not know of. Well, Apple earned $54 billion in revenue in the second quarter. Of that, $26 billion came from iPhone sales, the first time the iPhone represented less than half Apple's quarterly earnings since 2012. Services such as App Store and Apple Music brought in over $11 billion. And finally, some 490 million people in China watched NBA games last season on the live streaming platform Tencent. That's more than a third of China's population of 1.3 billion. Tencent recently paid an estimated $1.5 billion to extend its partnership with the NBA until 2005. And the average legroom in economy class has fallen by 5 inches since 2006. It's now 30 inches. You probably have noticed this. And the average seat width has narrowed to 17 inches. Cebu Pacific, the Philippines' biggest budget carrier, is cramming a record 460 seats into a new Airbus jet, twice as many as it was designed to fit. That's the news for the day. Nice to be with you once again after about a 3 months hiatus. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And remember, tune in next time for a little of this, a little of that. It's going to be a baseball show. And for this, thank you. Thank you again.